Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the Hossidathon, the podcast that trains apprentices in the films of one of the world's greatest animation directors, Mamoru Hosoda. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and these guys fill the hole in my heart.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Mamoru Hosoda. Jake, Steph, welcome back. Jake, it's such a treat to hear that we're filling the hole in your heart with these discussions, these podcasts, these films. You're holding up okay, right?
Yeah. You don't need to read too much into the opening gag. It'll be a real cry for help another time, I'm sure. But with this filmmaker, I'm managing through, although maybe that's a spoiler for some of the review section for this one.
Steph, how's the journey going for you? We're now kind of over the halfway mark, pretty much.
Yeah, it's going great. I'm sure in this episode we'll be following in your footsteps to learn all the ways of anime, Michael.
Yep, Steph and I have kept our microphones covered. We're only going to be unsheathing them in the last few moments of the conversation.
It's going to be perfectly bloodless to begin with, though.
Yeah.
But we should crack on talking this week about The Boy and the Beast, the fourth film in our mini-series. Well, we should kick off, as we always do, with a synopsis, and then we'll be diving into context and then a spoilery discussion. So listeners, if you haven't had the chance to watch The Boy and the Beast yet, go away and watch it. We'll be here when you come back. But for now, Steph, should we set up the film?
Let's do it. When Kyuta, a young orphan living on the streets of Shibuya, stumbles into a fantastic world of beasts, he's taken in by Kumatetsu, a gruff warrior beast who's searching for the perfect apprentice. Despite their constant bickering, Kyuta and Kumatetsu begin training together and slowly form a bond as surrogate father and son. But when a deep darkness threatens to throw the human and beast worlds into chaos, the strong bond between this unlikely pair will be put to the ultimate test. That's quite a long and full synopsis there, a lot going on. But Michael, what's going on behind the scenes of this film in the context?
Well, big changes in the life of our friend Hosoda. So we spoke previously about how he likes to draw inspiration from his own life when dreaming up these projects. Well, not long after he finished work on Wolf Children, he became a dad to a baby boy, and that informed what would become his next film, the one we're talking about today, The Boy and the Beast. I'm going to quote here from an interview that friend of the show, Andrew Osmond, conducted with Hosoda about the existential journey becoming a father puts you on. Hosoda says, "I'm just thinking as a parent, how is he, his son, going to grow up? How are we going to raise him? How is he going to relate to the world? Is he going to be able to find a soulmate or some master from whom he can learn about life? The story about a parent and a child is such a banal theme. I used to think that I couldn't make a movie out of it because it just was too ordinary. But now, in our modern times, I feel this is really the time to reevaluate what family means and what it means to the child. especially as the child might grow up thinking that the family was a certain way. As they grow up, the time comes when children start asking themselves about family and values. There is a gap between those two trains of thought, so I wanted to reflect on that through the film. And then as the idea developed, more ideas, of course, came to mind. This is from an interview that he gave with Funimation, the distributor, when the film came out. As it developed, he said, "I watched my child, who was about a year old at the time, maybe, and he was growing gradually bigger. And as I imagined him growing up, I thought of the idea for this movie. I thought, how much influence do I, as a father, have in my child's growth? How necessary is the father? Having just done the ultimate mum movie, he now wants to do the dad movie. In fact, there are many others beside myself who, as my son grows up, will become like parents to him. And from that, I imagined a young man with lots of different parents around him. And when I pictured that image, a story gradually emerged from it. And out of that, characters were born." So he reflects on that by developing a theme brought over from Wolf Children, that sense of being in between two worlds, two identities, and coming of age and asking the question, which world do you belong to? Neither, both. And the boy in this film, Kuta, has to ponder that as he grows up between, you know, having the first portion of his life in the real world with a family that he's estranged from, and then this new family set up in a fantasy world, and then back again. Hosoda has many returning collaborators on this project, lots of names we've mentioned before: Andrew Jojo and the art design, Daisuke Iga on costumes and character design, Takaki Yamashita as animation director, character designer, but one name doesn't return for this project, and that's Setoku Okudera, the screenwriter. And this is the first feature that we've discussed so far that Hosoda wrote solo, by himself, story and screenplay, which I'm sure we'll talk about that very shortly. The film was released July the 11th, 2015 in Japan, and it's a massive hit. It knocks Avengers Age of Ultron off the top spot at the box office, sells 500,000 tickets in its opening weekend, and goes on to become the second highest grossing Japanese film at the box office at the end of the year. In fact, it's only outgrossed by a spin-off of the Yokai Watch anime series, and two Hollywood productions beat it at the box office that year. So, Jake, 2015, there's a Disney animation and a franchise reboot that are the two top film, well, two films that outgross The
Disney
Boy and the Beast.
Animation. Moana?
Nope.
Ooh. Zootopia?
Nope.
Oh God, 2015 Disney. What was Disney?
It's not really one that I'd say out of the recent run of Disney features, probably not the one that's remembered the most, but it is a secret Marvel comics adaptation.
Oh, Big Hero 6.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which actually, character design there was by Jin Kim, who would work later on Belle, which we'll talk about in a couple of episodes' time.
Yeah. I forgot about Big Hero 6. That was a nice film. There's going to be a Baymax film. Or is it a series? Something.
I think
something
it's a Disney
Baymax
Plus series, yeah. Franchise reboot. Steph, do you have any ideas of a franchise reboot 2015? One of the highest grossing films of all time, I think. Oh. Perhaps out of proportion to the specific quality of this film.
Hmm. I mean, there's been so many in the past years. It's hard to know. 2015.
This film has had a sequel since then, and I think a further sequel has already been shot to come out next year.
Ooh.
Clearly, 2015, Steph and I were not paying attention to the box office.
I really was not.
And this is like one of the biggest films of the year, and neither of us can get it.
Well, Jake, you are a fan of Steven Spielberg.
Mm, I am.
And who is the natural successor to Steven Spielberg? It's Colin Trevorrow.
Oh, God. Is it Jurassic World? Wow.
Exactly, yeah. That was a big movie we tend to forget.
Yeah, it was huge. And yeah, the third one is next year. Gosh. Wow.
Clearly we loved him.
Yeah. Well, let's hope...
The Trevorrow series incoming next year.
Let's hope that The Boy and the Beast had more of a lasting impact on the both of you than Jurassic World.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So, almost over the halfway point, picking up steam, we have actually getting a gaining sense of who Hosta is as a filmmaker. We have the motifs, the recurring themes. Jake, anything different or new about The Boy and the Beast as we sit down to watch it?
Yeah, I think this looks surprisingly different to the previous films. I think there's a bit of a continuity between them, even though the setting between Wolf Children and the other films is very different. I think you can really track the through line between them stylistically. I think this one feels like the largest step away from that. I think, like, from a kind of technical craft perspective, he's introducing more 3D camera moves or virtual camera moves. And so right at the opening, you've got this like almost flame firework display of all of the beasts being represented in their more spiritual form. And it's lovely. It's almost like this, like a musical overture to the whole film, where it's all just kind of sound and light and this grand narration guiding you through all of these lovely lights in the dark. And I thought that was really lovely. And that gets revisited, this spinning, swirling movement, which has got to be an absolute nightmare to animate. And he does it again in the real world, in the middle of Shibuya Crossing, where all of these people kind of spinning around the camera. And again, the animators must have absolutely hated their director for that moment, but it does look really amazing. Just like these streams and streams of people coming from all directions. So that looks really cool. And then color-wise, I think this is a real change. I think it's gotten a real autumnal color palette. Lots of browns, maroons, reds. Both in the beast world and in the real world. So it gives it a kind of a warmer feeling, but a more melancholy feeling as well, I think. And you've got slightly thinner outlines on all the characters. So I wonder if that, along with the colours, is more of an approach to try and ground this more in reality. I think particularly in the real world city, that's the closest that we've seen him do like a more kind of tangible city feeling, even though we have seen him do that before. This felt the most lived in that respect for me.
His films so far have been mostly not suburban. Go Through Like the Time is sort of like that urban suburban feeling, not fully suburban. It still feels like a pretty big town setting, but this is like in the thick of it, of the densest populated area of Tokyo, the Shibuya Crossing. And he says in interviews that he feels that the pure energy of that crossing is the sort of thing that could be a gateway between worlds, because it is almost like this coming together of all these international tourists and people. And
it's interesting that he chooses for his characters to kind of part ways in Go Who Let Through Time on Shibuya Crossing as well. He's kind of bringing us back to that space again.
Well, and it's a great location for this kind of continuing theme of isolation and loneliness that we see through all of these films. It makes total sense to put that as what is essentially the most recognised busy pedestrian setting in the entire world, that is just chock full of people all the time. And so I think, yeah, it gives it a nice little bit of gravity to put your lonely people in that setting.
Yeah, this film, there's something interesting about this is that story-wise, it's the first time where he's had a firmer foot in a fantasy world rather than in the real world. The Girl Leapt Through Time and Wolf Children both have sci-fi or fantasy motifs in what is quite an everyday setting. Summer Wars has the cyber sci-fi conceit on top of a real world setting as well. It made me think of Neil Gaiman, particularly Neverwhere, which is a Neil Gaiman story about a mythological world that exists through the cracks of London, where all of the historical, mythological, legendary characters and creatures live. And it's one that is almost accessed by a homeless population is the route into that. So that sort of starting point here about having a homeless boy who is a boy who's run away from home, being able to move between these worlds is quite fascinating in a way. And that's something quite different for Hosoda to explore, having a fully realised fantasy world. What did you make of that, Jake?
I thought it really felt familiar to a lot of Eastern fantasy stories, particularly when we get into the beast world, which really has a Southern European, North African design to it. And so I was thinking of Chittagatse, the fantasy world in the second His Dark Materials book, but also because you're being led by the Lord, who is a white rabbit, and you're kind of being drawn into this world by fantastical creatures, you can't help but think of Alice in Wonderland as well. And for anyone that had the pleasure of seeing the Great Exhibition manga at the British Museum a few years ago, one of the big threads through the design of that entire exhibition was the role of the white rabbit and Alice in Wonderland and its influence on manga and anime. And so I kept thinking about this and like thinking about how that fantasy setting perhaps makes this more of an international story as well. Like, it just felt so familiar being in those settings, because that's just perhaps what we're used to from stories like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe or something like that, where it is this kind of tangible setting of whether it's a wardrobe or whether it's just a city street. It's not a big time warp situation. It is this feeling of fantasy being right on your doorstep, which is something we spoke about with The Cat Returns. I know we're not big on that film, but the idea that this magical world can just be found if you walk down the right streets of your city makes it so exciting that like any kid could stumble into the beast world is really cool. But I do think that going out to write on his screenplay by himself, perhaps he could have done with someone there with him to stop having as many ideas as he did.
Should we break down the ideas in this film? We've done so far, we've said almost in every episode so far, haven't we, that he likes to have his personal level, his conceptual level, and maybe multiple mezzanine levels in between as well. But what's at play here with The Boy and the Beast? The context, we talked about an exploration of family, an exploration of being a father, or at least a father figure, but also being a son. So, Jake, what's the anatomy of this film there for you?
God, well, yeah, I think there is a simpler version of this story that is a much better film. But I think he can't help himself with when he has an idea and he just shoves it into like a double album worth of songs and you just need someone to strip it back, I think. Maybe just leave it at even the demo tape. But this is got your kid whose family are broken apart because of divorce and death, and in a really, really heavy-handed intro with like social worker characters going, you remember that your family are divorced and that we cannot find and there's lots of dialogue like that kind of didactic performance throughout. So he ends up in this fantasy world, and then in the fantasy world he gets trained by the Beast, but then the Beast doesn't like him, and then very quickly the Beast does like him, and it kind of turns on a dime a bit. But then he's back in the real world after spending 9 years there, and he doesn't seem to care that much. Like, you think after 9 years away, you'd react a bit strongly. But then he gets really into education and wants to go to college. But then he has to go back to the beast world where there's a big fight. But then there is also another human in the beast world who has lost a piece of his heart. And is because of that, he's going to destroy the beast world and the normal world. And then there's a big fight that crosses both of them. And it's just like, this is only a 2-hour film with credits.
I think, yeah, on separate levels, all of those ideas are really interesting. But then, yeah, stuck together, it's and then there's so much.
Reconnecting with the dad, which I totally forgot.
Yeah. It's just like it's slotted in there. Yeah. Crazy. I think there's a really great, that central thing about Kumatetsu the Beast and Kyuto the Boy, like learning from each other and that kind of central thing about how to raise kids. And I think how fathers should raise sons particularly is really, really interesting when it kind of drills down into that. And there's so much in the first half that's really good about all of that stuff. And I just wanted to see that for longer. Like there's so much about strength not necessarily just being physical. And I think it definitely in terms of, I mean, I don't have sons or children, but like in terms of raising boys, it seems like a very particular thing to be focused on. Like, where does strength come from? It's not necessarily just being able to beat someone up. It's not necessarily resolving your issues with physical violence. And there's a really lovely sequence where they go to all the different lords of the land to learn about what strength is, and they get a lot of different answers. And well, Kyuta learns from it, but I don't
that
think
should be like a really
does,
long
but...
scene. Like, that scene is so beautiful. Yeah. Like, all of those settings are amazing. They've put in so much work to design these different lords, design their different realms. And we rattle through it in about 2 minutes because we've got to go and do another training montage and then get back into our apocalyptic battle. And it's like the central philosophies being discussed here are the most interesting bit. Like, stay here for a while. Come on.
I do wonder, he's a filmmaker. We've seen this even within the episodes we've done. And I wonder if we'll see this even in the rest of the miniseries. He likes to challenge himself. He likes to bring something new to the table. And I wonder whether after he did become a father and had those... yeah, that existential development process, having a kid and thinking about himself and the way that it puts yourself in a continuum of experience, a continuum of influential people within the life of this small child. Maybe he wanted to put that into a film, but didn't want to just do Wolf Children 2.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how flipping the metaphor from being the kids of the animals or the beasts to the father figure as a beast is like a one step away from that. And then he keeps adding things to try and make something new and challenge himself, which is a commendable thing, but maybe just one thing too many. And you're right, it is the strongest when it is about these relationships. But he's also very clearly wanting to challenge himself on a genre level, doing something much more action-based. He talks a lot in interviews about how much he loves Akira Kurosawa's films, so there's a lot of an exploration of a particular type of character that you see in there. Toshiro Mifune's kind of wild Ronin character that is clearly what the Beast is based on here. And then all these other type of male character archetypes, because it's easy. The English title is The Boy and the Beast, so that is the central relationship. It's on the poster. But when you hear him speak about all of the other people that have an impact on us as we grow, he's clearly talking about the other blokes, the other animals that live with him, like the monk-like kind of humanoid guy with a pig nose, or the more monkey-type character. You know, the monk is a pillar of strength and patience and calm. The monkey guy is like the ultimate edgelord, sarcastic guy. And it's more the monk, actually, that it gives him some important life lessons about how to center himself and observe the world around him. And that is something that he then allows him then, through mirroring the beast's movements and learning how the beast ticks, he can then get under his armor that way. But then, as you say, this other aspect, which is for me the one bridge too far, is the, let's call it, Chekhov's darkness, where very early on they say we can never train a human in the ways of our spirituality and our martial arts because they have darkness inside. And it's sort of very familiar to, I guess, from a lot of other anime series and films, this idea that teenagers go crazy. It's there in Akira onwards, that if you give teenagers any power, particularly boys, they'll go mad and go drunk with that power. And it's, I guess, the expectation is that Kyuta will go that way, but actually it's this other, very clearly a human, that is meant to be a surprise or a twist reveal when it turns out they're human later on. And that's one thing too many, because also it just feels like a very different sort of theme and motif to explore. Again, very on the nose, nail on head, visually expressed, literal gaping hole in their chest, but not really given that extra dimension or wisdom that we would associate with Hoster at this point, maybe.
Well, and it doesn't have the grounding in its style or the grounding in its theme in reality, that even though this is a beast world, the rest of the film really has. Like, even when you are like there with a monk with a pig nose and a monkey man, like, you really feel everything that they're saying, and it exists in a world that is tangible. And then the look of this hole in the heart and this kid with his big wide eyes and his gaping mouth and his explosive behavior, I suppose, just doesn't seem like a fit, and it just feels so tacked on. And it comes in at a 90-minute mark, and it's like the film could have just wrapped up here. Like, I feel like all the emotional lessons we needed to learn, we hit at this point, but we just needed to blow something up in the last half an hour. And that's something that we've talked about throughout this series already, and something that we may well go on to talk about, is just having to raise those stakes unnecessarily.
I guess, yeah, I feel like there's not much point in me saying kind of they should have done this with the story or whatever, because the film is the film. But I guess what I was expecting the conclusion to be was this Kyuta choosing between his like blood relative, like his dad, or Kumatetsu, his dad, who is technically his dad because he raised him throughout most of his childhood. And I guess like either having to compromise between the two, or like say goodbye to one and return to the human world, which is kind of where the story felt like it was going when he was getting more interested in going to school and reading Moby Dick and stuff like that. So it was quite kind of a weird shock for the story to kind of turn in that direction, when I feel like it was building to a really emotional conclusion, where it was going already.
Absolutely. It felt like for 90 minutes it could be like a fantasy animated version of a Koreeda film, like, and that you've got this arguably very melodramatic family situation going on that could be kind of a high wire act in the hands of another filmmaker, but feels very much real. And that reunion with the dad, where the dad is very gentle and isn't trying to like immediately cover his son in as much love as possible. They realise that they just need to take things kind of as they go, and he very much like offering him kind of autonomy, independence, to take his own life in his own hands. And all of that's really lovely. And you think, these two have a really interesting dynamic, and that's what I want to see explore. And how do you negotiate the two sides of this family? But instead, we've got a whale, a very beautiful whale, it has to be said, exploding on top of Shibuya.
The approach we take to these series, it's always quite interesting when we reach this point where we really feel like we know a filmmaker. And this is a very rare example, for me at least, where we can see a filmmaker wrestling with their ideas and maybe not cohering them in a way that we may now have expected from the previous episodes. So that the lack of Setoku Okudera feels significant to me. And hearing in the previous episodes where she would say that he'd come with like his barrel of ideas and she would have to shape it into something, or she'd do a pass of the screenplay, he'd do a pass and then come together and then finally do a pass together. It feels like there is a version of this film, and again, Steph, we're going into fan fiction territory where we're talking about the film that doesn't exist, but it could have just been about the relationship between him and the boy and the beast. The beast dies, and then he gives him the sword that is in his heart, and that's all that is necessary. That human story at the center of it, about loss and memory and the impact of these people in our lives. But he's wrestling with how to then give the boy something active to finish with, rather than just have that passive feeling, or maybe it is going back into Wolf Children territory where he needs something to end with. So it's really fascinating to see him just sort of like throwing that twist in the narrative late on to have and more I think action, like different that, type of action.
That really muddies the whole sword metaphor as well, which I think is really beautifully laid out for so long, like this idea of a world where there once were swords that people used to hurt each other, but then a law was put in place where they had to remain sheathed at all times, and that it was taboo to actually show the kind of the metal of a sword. Like that's a lovely piece of world building, and it makes you think, well, like what happened however many years ago for that to be in place. And so when you do see a sword do what a sword can do, you really feel it. Like that moment where the beast gets stabbed is shocking and really well put together, a lot like when Daddy Wolf in Wolf Children gets hit. It's a proper kind of gut punch moment. But then when you get to the big whale fight and he gets the sword in the heart, and the sword in the heart is a nice metaphor, and we've kind of had this pacifist trajectory throughout. But then he wins the fight by using the sword. And then someone says, did he kill him? And he said, no. But we didn't see how. We didn't actually. All we know is that in the end, the sword won the fight. And that goes against the philosophy that we've just been told about for 110 minutes. And if you just, again, if we're in the editing room, we can just go and go back to 90 minutes and just stitch our ending right there. It is frustrating, but it's really fascinating to see someone who is clearly obsessed with these same things just come back over and over again. Like we will come back to whales again in Bell, and these wolves which we've seen before, these beasts, beasts which we'll see again in Bell. It is really interesting how he seems to alter his feelings as he goes as well. Like here, a whale is a beautiful thing, but it is representative of kind of this weapon of mass destruction as well. But then we've seen a whale be something far nicer, and then in Bell we'll see it kind of be a speaker system that can connect the entire world. It's really interesting, because I suppose it's not often so on the level that you can just track someone's interests like that.
It's kind of reminiscent of our Satoshi Kon mini series, I feel like, where we've had similar themes being presented throughout the films as the filmmaker is working through these ideas and kind of developing what they want those ideas to turn into film after film. For me, this is very much that, especially in direct conversation with Wolf Children, just in terms of Wolf Children is so much about, you know, your kids will grow up to be their own people, they'll leave you behind and go off into the world. And then this is very much like, oh, you actually have so much influence over who your kids become and how they behave, and you have to learn to teach them. And it's like a really interesting thing to see him make, I guess, after he's just had a child and maybe realized that, parenting isn't this like one straight line and you just follow that and that's your goal for 18 years or whatever. It's like there's so much other stuff coming in.
Well, I think it's really cool that the film like gives dialogue on both sides of that interaction of what it means to be a child. It's not just Hosoda as a new father kind of projecting his concerns about what's going to come for him in the next 18 years or so. He gives Kyuta like some of the analysis as well, like what does it mean to be someone's child, like what is my role in this transaction, in this relationship, what do I need to do for them, and vice versa. And ultimately it's about what the beast gets from the boy in the end. Like it doesn't really matter the other way around. It's not like the boy obviously gets something from the beast and the sword in the heart, but the big learning curve for me is what the beast gets out of the boy. And in a way that arc ends at that three-quarter mark, and that's the most rewarding arc, and that's probably why all of us feel that that kind of back end feel so empty because we no longer have a connection between this character and the character he's been put up against, because it's that duo that we want to see.
What I find so fascinating about him as a filmmaker and going through the films chronologically in the way that we are is how he situates himself within the narrative as the storyteller. So we talk in the past about how Miyazaki would always be paternalistic, you know, quite didactic at times, always giving life lessons, and contrasted that with Hiramasa Yonabayashi in something like When Marnie Was There, where he is Anna. He is outside of the small circle that is drawn invisibly around society, and you're the outsider within that. And I think Hosoda resituates himself almost with every film as he gains life experience. And there's something quite profound there in the way that Wolf Children is his idealized version of parenthood, looking at his friends who are parents and saying, God, you're so cool doing this in your life. And these kids are these unruly animals in your house that you've got to bring up. But then a couple of years later, he flips, and actually the beast, the unruly animal, is himself that is being taught and developed and matured by the process of being a parent. And we'll just see that keep going as we go through the films. It's, you know, we've talked, Jake, both on mic and off mic, about Steven Spielberg and how his filmmaking changed when he became a parent. But I think that with Hosoda, it's more subtle but quite profound, the changes he goes through.
I really love that scene where he's trying to teach him how to control the sword properly, and he just keeps repeating the same thing, like, but louder. Like, why don't you understand this? Like, it's such a good kind of depiction of just not knowing how to teach in that way, like a
very much like got
from a different perspective,
got the bonnet of the car open and dad is just telling you to hold the torch in the right spot. It's just like, no, it's there. you mentioned his name, Michael, just on the Spielberg point. We mentioned him a few weeks ago in the same series about this kind of Hosoda's skill as a blocker and as a silent filmmaker, and I think you really get this here. I think some of the sequences in this film that are the strongest are when you remove that dialogue. I think the dialogue is iffy. I think it's perhaps his poorest script in that regard. But once you remove that, these sequences where we said in Wolf Children, where it's the pregnancy sequence or like the growing up sequence, here we see those 9 years of Cuta's life in the beast world kind of whip through in 5 minutes, but it's so gentle and you really feel that passage of time in such a beautiful way. And it's not just, it's telling you so much of that story in such a short space of time, just using the visual element. But then it's also in the combat sequences, which we haven't really seen him do before. I think you get a real clear geography in all of those sequences. I think you feel every punch. They're really long, and so you get a proper oomph out of them. The first one between the two main beasts, which is kind of in a town square, that's almost like creeping up to 10 minutes long, that fight. It's crazy. It reminded me of the one from They Live, the John Carpenter film, where it just keeps going. You think they're done and it never stops. But you really feel it. Like, they have such a great arc. Like, a good fight sequence should have this beginning, middle and end, and it should have like a few different acts in between, and like the moment when you think they're down and out and they get back up and someone shouts from the crowd and all of this. It's like these mini Rocky films that are planted in it. And I think he's so good at just planting you as the viewer in these spaces, whether that is in the space of a home or whether that is in the space of a coliseum.
Well, we're going to have to put the Boy and the Beast in the middle of the coliseum of the Hoss order and see how it dukes it out with the films we've discussed so far. Let's see how it shapes up. Okay, we need to rank the Hosoda films so far. Jake, let's quickly recap your list and where this would come within it.
So I was going Summer Wars, Wolf Children, Girl Who Leapt Through Time, and I would put this below The Girl Who Leapt Through Time for me. It's just his most uneven, most unsatisfying and least emotional work. But that being said, I still think it's very good.
I will agree with you. Yeah, so Summer Wars, Wolf Children, Girl Who Leapt Through Time, and then The Boy and the Beast. There is just this this glaring flaw structurally, one idea too many, that makes it 2 hours long and feels half an hour too long for me. Although so much to love, particularly Jake, just hearing you talk about the fight sequences just then made me want to go back and watch that first one again. So it's at the bottom of the table, but it's by no means a terrible
thing. Michael, as they say in the Premier League, it's still top four.
Exactly,
you're still getting a Champions League spot.
Steph, where would this land for you?
I'm realising that I have completely different opinions on these films to you guys. I think maybe I'm more of like a slice of life Hossiter lover, because my ranking is Wolf Children top, then Girl Who Leapt Through Time, then Summer Wars. I would put Boy and the Beast probably third above Summer Wars.
We're totally opposed.
We really are. And like, there's that really good like action in Summer Wars, and I think this builds on it, and you have those amazing fight scenes, and I just think that the central relationship has a lot to love in it. And I feel like this is one that I will probably return to and rewatch and reassess. So, yeah.
Wow. The schism in the podcast team. Let's see how that grows or narrows as things go on. But listeners, it would be amazing to hear what you make of Hossiter's films, particularly The Boy and the Beast. Let us know on Twitter at GhibliAtech. We're also on Instagram, GhibliAtech.pod. And you can email us, Ghibli@little.studios.com. We're also on social media individually. You can find Steph on Twitter, _StephWatts.
You can find Jake on Twitter at JakeHCunningham.
And you can find Michael at MichaelJLeader.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is by Anthony Ng, and the show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts.